None. And in a way, what you were saying about her speaking through this character, through Mary, I mean, well, let me just read it first. Mary's, what's the page in the other book? Did you find it? Yeah. Okay. I'd like to start on the second page, upset, she's expecting something grander in a chapel. They entered. Fanny's imagination had prepared her for something grander than a mere spacious oblong room fitted up for the purpose of devotion, with nothing more striking or more solemn than the profusion of mahogany and the crimson velvet cushions appearing over the ledge of the family gallery above. "I am disappointed," said she in a low voice to Edmund. "This is not my idea of a chapel. There is nothing awful here, nothing melancholy, nothing grand. Here are no aisles, no arches, no inscriptions, no banners. No banners, cousin, to be blown by the night wind of heaven. No signs that a Scottish monarch sleeps below. You forget, Fanny, how lately all this has been built, and for how confined a purpose compared with the old chapels of castles and monasteries. It was only for the private use of the family. They have been buried, I suppose, in the parish church. There you must look for the banners and their achievements. It was foolish of me not to think of that at all, but I am disappointed." Mrs. Rushworth began her relation. "This chapel was fitted up, as you see it, in James II's time. Before that period, as I understand, the pews were only wainscot, and there is some reason to think that the linings and cushions of the pulpit and family seat were only purple cloth. But this is not quite certain. It is a handsome chapel and was formerly in constant use both morning and evening. Prayers were always read in it by the domestic chaplain within the memory of many, but the late Mr. Rushworth left it off." "Every generation has its improvements," said Miss Crawford with a smile to Edmund. Mrs. Rushworth was gone to repeat her lesson to Mr. Crawford, and Edmund, Fanny, and Miss Crawford remained in a cluster together. "It is a pity," cried Fanny. This is sort of the first time she speaks her mind, actually. "It's a pity," cried Fanny, "that the custom should have been discontinued. It was a valuable part of former times. There is something in a chapel and chaplain, so much in character with a great house, with one's ideas of what such a household should be. A whole family assembling regularly for the purpose of prayer is fine." "Very fine indeed," said Miss Crawford, laughing. "It must do the heads of the family a great deal of good to force all the poor housemaids and footmen to leave business and pleasure and say their prayers here twice a day while they are inventing excuses themselves for staying away." "That is hardly family's idea of a family assembling," said Edmund. "If the master and mistress do not attend themselves, there must be more harm than good in the custom. At any rate, it is safer to leave people to their own devices on such subjects. Everybody likes to go their own way, to choose their own time and manner of devotion. The obligation of attendance, the formality, the restraint, the length of time, altogether it is a formidable thing, and what nobody likes. And if the good people who used to kneel and gape in that gallery could have foreseen that the time would ever come when men and women might lie another 10 minutes in bed when they woke with a headache without danger of reprobation because chapel was missed, they would have jumped with joy and envy. Cannot you imagine with what unwilling feelings the former belles of the House of Rushworth did many a times repair to this chapel? The young Mrs. Eleanors and Mrs. Bridgets, starched up into seeming piety, but with heads full of something very different, especially if the poor chaplain were not worth looking at. And in those days, I fancy parsons were very inferior even to what they are now." For a few moments, she was unanswered. Fanny colored and looked at Edmund, but felt too angry for speech. Angry. And he needed a little recollection before he could say, "Your lively mind can hardly be serious, even on serious subjects. You have given us an amusing sketch, and human nature cannot say it was not so. We must all feel at times the difficulty of fixing our thoughts as we could wish. But if you are supposing it a frequent thing, that is to say, a weakness grown into a habit from neglect, what could be expected from the private devotions of such persons? Do you think the minds which are sufficed, which are suffered, which are indulged in wanderings in a chapel would be more collected in a closet? Yes, very likely. They would have two chances at least in their favor. They would be less to distract the attention from without and would not be tried so long. The mind which does not struggle against itself under one circumstance would find objects to distract it in the other, I believe, and the influence of the place and of example may often rouse better feelings than are begun with. The greater length of the service, however, I admit to be sometimes too hard a stretch upon the mind. One wishes it were not so, but I have not yet left Oxford long enough to forget what chapel prayers are. While this was passing, the rest of the party being scattered about the chapel, Julia called Mr. Crawford's attention to her sister by saying, "Do look at Mr. Rushworth and Maria standing side by side, exactly as if the ceremony were going to be performed. Have not they completely the air of it?" Mr. Crawford smiled his acquiescence and, stepping forward to Maria, said in a voice which she only could hear, "I do not like to see Miss Bertram so near the altar." Starting, the lady instinctively moved a step or two, but recovering herself in a moment, affected to laugh and asked him in a tone not much louder if he would give her away. "I'm afraid I should do it very awkwardly," was his reply, with a look of meaning. Julia, joining them at the moment, carried on the joke. "Upon my word, it is really a pity that it should not take place directly if we had but a proper license, for here we are all together, and nothing in the world could be more snug and pleasant." And she talked and laughed about it with so little caution as to catch the comprehension of Mr. Rushworth and his mother and expose her sister to the whispered gallantries of her lover, while Mrs. Rushworth spoke with proper smiles and dignity of its being a most happy event to her whenever it took place. "If Edmund were but in orders," cried Julia, and running to where he stood with Miss Crawford and Fanny, "My dear Edmund, if you were but in orders now, you might perform the ceremony directly. How unlucky that you are not ordained. Mr. Rushworth and Maria are quite ready." Miss Crawford's countenance, as Julia spoke, might have amused a disinterested observer. She looked almost aghast under the new idea she was receiving. Fanny pitied her. "How distressed she will be at what she just said now," passed across her mind. "Ordained," cried Miss Crawford. "What, are you to be a clergyman?" "Yes, I shall take orders soon after my father's return, probably at Christmas." Miss Crawford, rallying her spirits and recovering her complexion, replied only, "If I had known this before, I would never have spoken of the cloth. I would have spoken of the cloth with more respect," and turned the subject. The chapel was soon afterwards left to the silence and stillness which reigned in it with few interruptions throughout the year. Miss Bertram, displeased with her sister, led the way, and all seemed to feel that they had been there long enough. It's a complicated scene. It's almost like some of Shakespeare's scenes where he has, you know, five or six different characters carrying on. I think there's a scene in Troilus and Cressida when actually some of the characters are hidden. So characters are so commenting on other characters, and they're also in this particular setting, which is a chapel. Actually, some of, like the scene in the right after the chapter after this, where they're outside at the gate, and they're taking that walk, sort of allows her this great freedom to sort of get these ironies out. I mean, it's so ironical that here's this marriage, you know, this joke about the marriage, which is going to, as you know, turns into this disaster. And there's this discussion of piety versus the people who want, the couples who want to stay in bed 10 minutes longer. And then you have this revelation that Edmund's going to be a clergyman, and then all that complexity and Mary's emotions about him, how she starts changing her mind. In fact, if anything, that's a challenge to her to hear that. Yeah.
Do you think she knew how it was going to turn out?
I think it's a highly structured book. I mean, the fact that it's really in these two parts, and you have this passive character, observing everything and then being like the center, of everything, and how the characters move and change and evolve is definitely a pattern. Oh yeah, I'm sure she's super conscious of her structure. I want to read, there's one other, this scene here. This, the contrast between, of course, Fanny and Mary is so extraordinary. I mean, this vitality and then this sickly character who can't even, you know, walk a mile without, or cut, she can't even cut roses, you know, out in the garden without fainting. And the whole scene with the horses, you know, the horse riding. And of course she comes and, Mary comes and takes, really sort of takes the horse away from her. Later has to apologize. And Mary's reaction to this idea of ordination, somehow that seems like some loss of manhood on Edmund's part, somehow a threat to his manhood. So you have this kind of thing set up between almost stasis and activity, or spiritedness, and the question is, you know, what does that have to do with, I mean, how does virtue or morality, such a weird word, but play a part in that? This other scene is, I mean, it's a great example. She can't even move, get off the bench, and so of course the one she loves goes off with the other woman.
An interesting setting in that they're in this artificial, right, really artificial wilderness. They refer to it as the wilderness, and there's the locked gate, which the master of the house has to go back, but of course no one pays any attention to it. It shows sort of his impotence in the situation really early. Really
it's early. A real almost sexual metaphor, too, this gate, where, you know, who's going to go beyond it.
And the ones who stay. Fanny, of course, is out of it because she doesn't know anything. She just sees them disappear over the hill.
I'd love it. Some of Crawford's her comments in here are so great in this chapter. Is this chapter 10? Resting fatigues me. I cannot be dictated to by a watch. Something. Someone said that to me the other day. I cannot be dictated to by a watch. Wait a minute. Oh, I'm sorry. This is Chapter 10. I wanted, though, to skip ahead just to this. You don't have to go to this page, but it's Fanny talking. She rarely gets carried away. She got carried away in that chapel about how it, you know, she wants it to be so much more. But here she's looking out the window. And Edmund is looking after, watching Miss Crawford leave. "There goes good humor, I'm sure," said he presently. "There goes a temper which would never give pain. How well she walks, and how readily she falls in with the inclination of others, joining them the moment she is asked. What a pity," he added after an instant's reflection, "that she should have been in such hands." He's referring to her upbringing. They decide that it's her upbringing which has made her a little too fast and surfacey. Okay. Fanny agreed to it and had the pleasure of seeing him continue at the window with her in spite of the expected glee, and of having his eyes soon turned like hers towards the scene without, where all that was solemn and soothing and lovely appeared in the brilliancy of an unclouded night and the contrast of the deep shade of the woods. Fanny spoke her feelings. "Here's harmony," said she. "Here's repose. Here's what may leave all painting and all music behind, and what poetry can only attempt to describe. Here's what may tranquilize every care and lift the heart to rapture. When I look out on such a night as this, I feel as if there could be neither wickedness nor sorrow in the world, and there certainly would be less of both if the sublimity of nature were more attended to and people were carried more out of themselves by contemplating such a scene. I like to hear your enthusiasm, Fanny. It is a lovely night, and they are much to be pitied who have not been taught to feel in some degree as you do, who have not at least been given a taste for nature in early life. They lose a great deal. You taught me to think and feel on the subject, cousin. I had a very apt scholar. There's Arcturus looking very bright. Yes, and the bear. I wish I could see Cassiopeia. We might go out on the lawn. We must go out on the lawn for that. Should you be afraid? Not in the least. It is a great while since we have had any stargazing. Yes, I do not know how it has happened. The glee began. We will stay till this is finished, Fanny, said he, turning his back on the window. And as it advanced, she had the mortification of seeing him advance too, moving forward by gentle degrees towards the instrument. And when it ceased, he was close by the singers, among the most urgent in requesting to hear the glee again. Fanny sighed alone at the window, still scolded away by Mrs. Norris's threats of catching cold. I love this line. Fanny said he, comma, turning his back on the window, then semicolon, and as it advanced, sounds like, and as his back advanced, and as it advanced, she had the mortification of seeing him advance too. But it's the glee. It's sort of ambiguous. So. Okay. Where's that bench scene? I want to. Oh, here it is. Page 127. Chapter 10.
Is it very
I don't know. Should we read it from the beginning, or I sort of wanted to. Okay, we'll start at the beginning. Does anyone else feel like reading? Is that Simone? Yeah. A quarter of an hour, 20 minutes passed away, and Fanny was still thinking of Edmund, Miss Crawford, and herself without interruption from anyone. She began to be surprised at being left so long and to listen with an anxious desire of hearing their steps and their voices again. She listened, and at length she heard voices and feet approaching, but she had just satisfied herself that it was not those she wanted when Miss Bertram, Mr. Rushworth, and Mr. Crawford issued from the same path which she had trod herself and were before her. Miss Price all alone? And my dear Fanny, how comes this? Were the first salutations. She told her story. Poor dear Fanny, cried her cousin, how ill you have been used by them. You had better have stayed with us. Then seating herself with a gentleman on either side, she resumed the conversation which had engaged them before and discussed the possibility of improvements with such animation. Nothing was fixed on, but Henry Crawford was full of ideas and projects, and generally speaking, whatever he proposed was immediately approved, first by her and then by Mr. Rushworth, whose principal business seemed to be to hear the others, and who scarcely risked an original thought of his own beyond a wish that they had seen his friend Smith's place. After some minutes spent in this way, Miss Bertram, observing the iron gate, expressed a wish of passing through it into the park, that their views and their plans might be more comprehensive. It was the very thing of all others to be wished. It was the best. It was the only way of proceeding without any advantage, in Henry Crawford's opinion, and he directly saw a knoll not half a mile off, which would give them exactly the requisite command of the house. It's a great sentence. It was the very thing of all others to be wished. It was the best. It was the only way of proceeding without any advantage. Go, therefore, they must to that knoll and through that gate, but the gate was locked. Mr. Rushworth wished he had brought the key. He had been very near thinking whether he should not bring the key. He was determined he would never come without the key again, but still this did not remove the present evil. They could not get through, and as Miss Bertram's inclination for so doing did by no means lessen, it ended in Mr. Rushworth's declaring outright that he would go and fetch the key. He set off accordingly. It is undoubtedly the best thing we can do now, as we are so far from the house already, said Mr. Crawford when he was gone. It's another thing, when they get far away from the house, things sort of get a little haywire or out of control. And actually that comes up in the play, as well. You know, they're in this artificial or situation that's kind of away from home. It is undoubtedly the best thing we can do now. We are so far from the house already, said Mr. Crawford when he was gone. Yes, there is nothing else to be done. But now, sincerely, do not you find the place altogether worse than you expected? No, indeed, far otherwise. I find it better, grander, more complete in its style, though that style may not be the best. And to tell you the truth, speaking rather lower, I do not think that I shall ever see Southerton again with so much pleasure as I do now. Another summer will hardly improve it to me. After a moment's embarrassment, the lady replied, you are too much a man of the world not to see with the eyes of the world. If other people think Southerton improved, I have no doubt that you will. I'm afraid I'm not quite so much the man of the world as might be good for me in some points. My feelings are not quite so evanescent, nor my memory of the past under such easy dominion as one finds to be the case with men of the world. This was followed by a short silence. Miss Bertram began again. You seem to enjoy your drive here very much this morning. I was glad to see you so well entertained. You and Julia were laughing the whole way. Were we? Yes, I believe we were. But I have not the least recollection at what. Oh, I believe I was relating to her some ridiculous stories of an old Irish groom of my uncle's. Your sister loves to laugh. You think her more lighthearted than I am. More easily amused, he replied. Consequently, you know, smiling, better company. I would not have hoped to entertain you with Irish anecdotes during a 10 miles drive. Naturally, I believe I am as lively as Julia, but I have more to think of now. You have undoubtedly, and there are situations in which very high spirits would denote insensibility. Your prospects, however, are too fair to justify want of spirits. You have a very smiling scene before you. Do you mean literally or figuratively? Literally, I conclude. Yes, certainly, the sun shines and the park looks very cheerful. But unluckily, that iron gate, that ha-ha, give me a feeling of restraint and hardship. I cannot get out, as the starling said. As she spoke, and it was with expression, she walked to the gate. He followed her. Mr. Rushworth is so long fetching this key. And for the world, you would not get out without the key and without Mr. Rushworth's authority and protection, or I think you might with little difficulty pass around the edge of the gate here with my assistance. I think it might be done if you really wish to be more at large and could allow yourself to think it not prohibited. Prohibited? Nonsense. I certainly can get out that way, and I will. Mr. Rushworth will be here in a moment, you know. We shall not be out of sight. Or if we are, Miss Price will be so good as to tell him that he will find us near that knoll, the grove of oak and on the knoll. Fanny, feeling all this to be wrong, could not help making an effort to prevent it. You will hurt yourself, Miss Bertram, she cried. You will certainly hurt yourself against those spikes. You will tear your gown. You will be in danger of slipping into the ha-ha. You had better not go. Her cousin was safe on the other side while these words were spoken, and smiling with all the good humor of success, she said, thank you, my dear Fanny, but I and my gown are alive and well, and so goodbye. Fanny was left again to her solitude and with no increase of pleasant feelings, for she was sorry for almost all that she had been seen and heard, astonished at Miss Bertram and angry with Mr. Crawford. By taking a circuitous and, as it appeared to her, very unreasonable direction to the knoll, they were soon beyond her eye, and for some minutes longer she remained without sight or sound of any companion. She seemed to have the little wood all to herself. She could almost have thought that Edmund and Miss Crawford had left it, but that it was impossible for Edmund to forget her so entirely. She was again aroused from disagreeable musings by sudden footsteps. Someone was coming at a quick pace down the principal walk. She expected Mr. Rushworth, but it was Julia, who, hot and out of breath, and with a look of disappointment, cried out on seeing her, Heyday, where are the others? I thought Maria and Mr. Crawford were with you. Fanny explained, A pretty trick, upon my word. I cannot see them anywhere, looking eagerly into the park, but they cannot be very far off, and I think I am equal to as much as Maria, even without help. But Julia, Mr. Rushworth will be here in a moment with the key. Do wait for Mr. Rushworth. Not I. Indeed, I have had enough of the family for one morning. Why, child, I have but this moment escaped from this horrible mother. His horrible mother, such a penance as I have been enduring while you were sitting here so composed and so happy. It might have been as well, perhaps, if you had been in my place, but you always contrive to keep out of these scrapes. This was a most unjust reflection, but Fanny could allow for it and let it pass. Julia was vexed and her temper was hasty, but she felt that it would not last, and therefore, taking no notice, only asked her if she had not seen Mr. Rushworth. Yes, yes, we saw him. He was posting away as if upon life and death, and could but just spare time to tell us his errand and where you all were. It is a pity that he should have so much trouble for nothing. That is Miss Maria's concern. I am obliged to punish myself for her sins. The mother I could not avoid, as long as my tiresome aunt was dancing about with the housekeeper, but the son I can get away from. And she immediately scrambled across the fence and walked away, not attending to Fanny's last question of whether she had seen anything of Miss Crawford and Edmund. The sort of dread in which Fanny now sat of seeing Mr. Rushworth prevented her thinking so much of their continued absence, however, as she might have done. She felt that he had been very ill-used and was quite unhappy in having to communicate what had passed. He joined her within 5 minutes after Julia's exit, and though she made the best of the story, he was evidently mortified and displeased in no common degree. At first he scarcely said anything. His looks only expressed his extreme surprise and vexation, and he walked to the gate and stood there without seeming to know what to do. They desired me to stay. My cousin Maria charged me to say that you would find them at the Knoll or thereabouts. I do not believe I shall go any further, said he sullenly. I see nothing of them. By the time I get to the Knoll, they may be gone somewhere else. I have had walking enough. And he sat down with the most gloomy countenance by Fanny. I am very sorry, said she. It is very unlucky. And she longed to be able to say something more to the purpose. After an interval of silence, I think they might as well have stayed for me, said he. Miss Bertram thought you would follow her. I should not have had to follow her if she had stayed. This could not be denied, and Fanny was silenced. After another pause, he went on, Pray, Miss Price, are you such a great admirer of this Mr. Crawford as some people are? For my part, I can see nothing in him. I do not think him at all handsome. Handsome? Nobody can call such an undersized man handsome. He is not 5'9". I should not wonder if he was not more than 5'8". I think he is an ill-looking fellow. In my opinion, these Crawfords are no addition at all. We did very well without them. A small sigh escaped Fanny here, and she did not know how to contradict him. If I had made any difficult... It's another thing she does is has characters united at certain points, you know, which increases this sort of tapestry and weave. They couldn't be further alike, except they're both sort of wallflowers, I guess. If I had made any difficulty about fetching the key, there might have been some excuse, but I went the very moment she said she wanted it. Nothing could be more obliging than your manner, I'm sure, and I dare say you walked as fast as you could, but still it is some distance, you know, from this spot to the house, quite into the house. And when people are waiting, they are bad judges of time, and every half minute seems like 5. She's really speaking for herself, since Edmund's off. He got up and walked to the gate again, and wished he had had the key about him at that time. Fanny thought she discerned in his standing there an indication of relenting, which encouraged her to another attempt, and she said, therefore, It is a pity you should not join them. They expected to have a better view of the house from that part of the park, and will be thinking how it may be improved, and nothing of that sort, you know, can be settled without you. She found herself more successful in sending away than in retaining a companion. Mr. Rushworth was worked on. Well, said he, if you really think I'd better go, it would be foolish to bring the key for nothing. And letting himself out, he walked off without further ceremony. And it goes on. I just want to read the very end. My dear, it is only a beautiful little heath which that nice old gardener would make me take. But if it is in your way, I will have it in my lap directly. There, Fanny, you shall carry that parcel for me. Take great care of it. Do not let it fall. It is a cream cheese, just like the excellent one we had at dinner. Nothing would satisfy that good old Mrs. Whittaker but my taking one of the cheeses. I stood out as long as I could, till the tears almost came into her eyes. I knew it was just the sort that my sister would be delighted with. That Mrs. Whittaker is a treasure. She was quite shocked when I asked her whether wine was allowed at the second table. And she has turned away 2 housemaids for wearing white gloves. Take care of the cheese, Fanny. Now I can manage the other parcel in the basket very well. What else have you been sponging? Said Maria, half pleased that Southerton should be so complimented. Sponging, my dear, it is nothing but 4 of those beautiful pheasant's eggs, which Mrs. Whittaker would quite force upon me. She would not take a denial. She said it must be such an amusement to me, as she understood I lived quite alone, to have a few living creatures of this sort. And so, to be sure, it will. I shall get the dairymaid to set them under the first spare hen, and if they come to good, I can have them moved to my own house and borrow a coop. And it will be a great delight to me in my lonely hours to attend to them. And if I have good luck, your mother shall have some. It was a beautiful evening, mild and still, and the drive was as pleasant as the serenity of nature could make it. But when Mrs. Norris ceased speaking, it was altogether a silent drive to those within. Their spirits were in general exhausted, and to determine whether the day had afforded most pleasure or pain might occupy the meditations of almost all. Just a couple more notes. I guess next time we'll finish up with this. I'd just like to read a few more chapters. And if you could get on with the Virginia Woolf, appreciate it.